to look ahead a little bit. I corresponded a little bit with Norm the other day, and he asked me a question about what we're going to be covering. And I know they've been dealing with COVID and unable to get out as much. And I think he's been reading ahead, and it's really helped him. I've been really concerned that we've been throwing too much information at you. And so it really will help if you look forward. Of course, it's a fine time to tell you that since we're near the end of the class. We organized the material into 17 periods, Lord willing, starting the month of November. We will begin to study a detailed study. Is it 4 years we're studying it now? 3.5, 4 years? I think we expanded a little bit. It is 4 years now. We expanded a little bit from our original 3.5 years to devote a little more time. So if you're really interested in studying a survey of the Bible story from start to finish, such as what is depicted here, our study is a 17-period-based study. Again, there's nothing inspired about that necessarily. Just the way that the Waldron's really organized it, and we've adapted that here. And if you've been here for as long as I have, 28 years or so, you may have gone through that a few times, but it's probably been a while. We've had a lot of turnover in terms of just the representation of the congregation, and the elders decided that it'd be a good time to start studying that again. So Lord willing, we'll be doing that in November, so hopefully we'll all look forward to that. Again, we emphasized our last class a lot of material on the years of silence, and we'll go back and look at that just a little bit. But today, we'll be emphasizing a lot of material from the life of Christ. Let's go back a little bit and remind ourselves some of the things we talked about, Jewish and world affairs during biblical silence. The rise of the Grecian Empire, as was predicted in the Bible back in Daniel, numerous chapters in the Bible in the book of Daniel deal with the rise of the Grecian Empire. Although he's not called by name, Alexander very clearly is identified in the book of Daniel. His very short-lived reign, but very successful, he was able to establish the Grecian Empire and establish supremacy, I guess superiority over the Medo-Persian Empire that had been in place. But he died at a young age of 32, and then his power was divested into four of his generals. Again, the Bible makes that very clear. It's figurative language and prophetic language, but it's obvious language. And if you look back and compare history of what happened to what the Bible says, it's very evident. Again, and the Bible, of course, in the book of Daniel is speaking 150 or so years in advance. But eventually, the Syrian or Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire in Egypt became the more dominant. Again, that was also predicted in the Bible. The Greeks were very promoting their culture and their language and their philosophy, so it became a way of life throughout the empire. If you grew up during that time, you were educated in Greek and learned how to speak Greek. But eventually, the Syrian Empire becomes dominant. Again, Daniel, the 11th chapter, I believe it is, called the Syrian Wars, where you have wars that are occurring between the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid or Egypt and Syrian empires. So we have the Syrian Empire in place. One particular ruler that seems evident is pointed to in the Bible is Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the king of Syria. He forbade the Jews from practicing their religion. He desecrated the temple by organizing and promoting this worship of Zeus. I believe he even brought a statue of Zeus into the temple. And he actually declared himself to be Zeus. Brought swine onto the altar. And you can imagine, think about that. To have swine offered. Well, if you were a Jew, you didn't like that. And that helped initiate what is called the Maccabean Revolt. It's not specifically mentioned in the Bible necessarily. Started initially by, my mind's gone blank, his last name was Hasmoneus or Hasmoneus. But his sons really took control. One particular by the name of Judas, who was called the Hammer or Maccabees. And he became known as Judas Maccabees. And he helped initiate a period of time where the Jews were actually able to reclaim control of Jerusalem. He cleansed the temple and helped gain independence of Judah. In fact, and I can't remember if it's my next chart or... Let me just get my charts in front of me here. Hanukkah actually commemorates relighting of the lamps in the temple that occurred as a result of the Maccabean revolt. Jesus actually participated in feasts and events. I believe it was the Feast of Dedication during his day that commemorated that same event. It's called Hanukkah today. Well, we talked about the establishment and the development of Jewish sects, different groups of religious groups within Judaism that had a particular way that they looked at things. The Pharisees were very strict. They were well-intentioned. They were emphasized careful obedience to the law, but they went to a point where they actually created traditions and rules aimed at keeping law careful, very carefully. The problem is those traditions themselves became laws, and that conflicted with Jesus' teaching when he came. The Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, initiated by the Ptolemies, or one particular Ptolemy in Egypt. Many of the New Testament writers quoted from it. We can see that evident on people who study language and know what the Septuagint says and look at the quote. It's evident that they're quoting from it. You think about the spread of the Greek language and the ability now to actually read the Old Testament in Greek, if you were able to speak Greek, which many people were. So that helped spread Judaism and actually even later on Christianity. Jewish synagogues were established in many cities. I believe it was 10 men, I believe, Jewish men required to establish a synagogue. We talked about the Essenes and how they collected writings. Those writings were stored in caves in a community known as Qumran on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. Those were preserved. Again, this is extra-biblical stuff, but it's interesting and helps us understand some things today. Many manuscripts, many of which were way older than what had been used to translate the Bible, even in the King James Version, and these old writings helps us understand that the Bible really hasn't lost its meaning over time, that it has not been corrupted as many would claim today. Big change in terms of attitude concerning idolatry. It was now abhorred by the Jews. One thing that had been a problem Jews over the years now has become something that they seem to have learned their lesson. They learned their lesson with respect to idolatry, and now they abhor it, which is a good thing, obviously. And now we see the expansion of the Roman Empire. You know, as one empire diminishes and another rises, that still happens today. And Lord willing, it's likely to happen even to our own country at some point. But you see the Roman Empire now conquers Syria and expands to control much of the Mediterranean world. The Herod family gains control initially by the name of a man known as Antipater. But Herod the Great, I think I've got a chart here in a minute that'll talk about the Herods. Again, recall the name of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2, four world empires. We just finished the Greek. Now we're seeing the emergence of the Roman Empire. And again, what was specific about the Roman Empire relative to the kingdom of God? In the days of the Roman Empire, God was going to establish his eternal kingdom. And we see that happening. Well, the years of silence ended when Gabriel announced the birth of John the Baptist to Zacharias, as we read in Luke, the first chapter. How many years transpired? 400 years. Keep in mind, too, though, um, You know, we read the Bible, read a very condensed version of things that happen in revelations and prophecies and things like that. But there were long gaps of time. I mean, there was just wasn't just revelation going on all the time, right? I guess we think maybe in our own minds, if we're living in a world where revelation occurred, that was just happening all the time. That really didn't seem to be the case at all. But this period of time, as was prophesied in the book of Amos, indicates that there was about 400 years that God did not reveal anything at all. Herod the Great reigned over Judea at the time that Christ was born. He was a tyrant, very paranoid individual. He would actually hear a rumor of someone who might be disloyal to him or might be somebody that is not following him. He'd have them killed, or they'd show up killed, including members of his own family. I believe it, I read even some of his own sons were killed. So the power that these people had and the ability they had to eliminate their competition, you had to walk a real tight line if you were living during this time frame. But Herod died shortly after Jesus was born, about 4 BC. It's estimated that Jesus was born somewhere in the 4 to 6 BC range. Obviously, he was in place because we read about their flight to Egypt, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute. Again, this is just a depiction table of the Herod family. It begins with Herod the Great, of course. Antipater would be his father up here. When Herod the Great died, his territory would have been split between Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip II, I believe. But you'll see other characters that we read about. Now, there are characters here that we don't necessarily know about in terms of Bible knowledge, but, of course, secular history shows that they were in place. Herodias, you remember her, married Antipas. She's talked about in Mark the 6th chapter. Herod Agrippa the 1st in Acts the 2nd chapter. Herod Agrippa the 2nd as well. See some of these names, Drusilla, Berenice, Salome. Again, characters that we read about in the Bible. This would have been kind of the ruling class of the Israelites. So, what was the relationship between the Herod family and Jews? Anybody remember? Were the Herods Jews in in terms of a family sense? In a sense, they were. They were Idumeans, weren't they? Idumeans were descended from whom?
Esau
or Edom. In fact, I think you kind of see there's kind of a play on the word there, Idumea or Edom. You can kind of see the relationship between the words there. And maybe that occurred due to the Hellenization of words that we talked about last week. But, again, I don't want to spend too much time on this. This really wasn't on our syllabus. And don't confuse Cleopatra up here. And hopefully, I don't know if you can see this, how well you can see this. Don't confuse this Cleopatra with the Cleopatra of Egypt. And Mark Antony, that is a different Cleopatra. All right, moving on. Well, the Bible talks about a fullness of time that occurred when Christ was brought into the world. God's plan was in place before the world was created. But it reached the point that it was the fullness of time for him to come. The time that God determined that was right for Jesus to come into the world. And of course, the fullness of time is mentioned both in Galatians 4 and Ephesians 1, and it is in reference to Jesus there. Well, we have an empire now controlling lands surrounding the Mediterranean Sea and beyond. I think we talked about even last Wednesday how the Roman Senate had given charge to Pompey that they wanted to have the Mediterranean lands or the coast of the Mediterranean controlled up through 50 miles inland. There were advantages to being ruled by the Romans. They established good roads for travel. You think about the terrain that people had to travel during those days, and some of those routes were established not necessarily the shortest pray, but the easiest way to go around mountains and so forth. But it allowed for good roads, good communication. The Greek language, as we've already noted, is now dominating the empire. Many people speak and read Greek. There was a period of time from about 27 BC to 180 DED, Pax Romana, or Roman peace. If I didn't put the translation, we could have asked Lorenzo to interpret for us, but this is one we know without having an Italian interpret for us. Maybe that's Greek. So I don't know if you know Greek or not, Lorenzo, but anyway, I think most of us have heard of Pax Romana. But that helped the Bible say these things. So we want to be careful with that, about assuming too much. But just looking at the political conditions and the political state and the infrastructure that existed and the language that was there, it seems evident that this was a good time for Christ to come into the world and to begin his mission. The Romans and the Herod family allowed the Jews some political and religious independence. They were largely able to take care of their own affairs. Remember when Jesus was brought before the Romans? And what was, the Romans were like, take him yourselves and deal with him. And they're like, no, we've got a law, and our law says he ought to die. And they were not allowed to put anybody to death under Roman law. So that's why they had to go to the Romans to try to crucify Jesus. But again, up to that, they were largely able to deal with their own affairs. The Romans, of course, improved cities. The reconstruction of the temple was brought about initially by Herod the Great, continued for about 80-something years, 84 years, to where it became a very marvelous place, even better, much better than what Zerubbabel had helped rebuild during his day. So here is the Roman Empire. As you see, we have emphasized the fact that they wanted to control the Mediterranean. The empire extended really up through the British Channel, down into Spain. This area would be modern-day France, much of it, maybe parts of Germany. You can see, obvious Italy, over to Macedonia, all over into Armenia, down along the coast. This is, of course, the area of Judea, down into Egypt. And you can see that they kind of accomplished their goal of controlling lands 50 miles inward. If you controlled the major means of shipment of goods and transportation from one part of the world, known world, to the other, you were controlling a lot. And you were able to control commerce, again, as you, those seaports and things like that. We learn, of course, in the first century, they had learned to navigate very well. And, of course, the Apostle Paul takes advantage of that in terms of movement across the empire from place to place to spread the gospel. They were very adept at sea travel and things like that. So, again, the Romans are controlling that. And this is would have been the case when Christ came. You never see anybody really conquer Arabia. Is there a reason for that? Yeah, it's kind of why you don't see anybody caring too much about northern Canada. Because it's Canada's not desert, but it's an area that's almost uninhabitable. So there's not a lot of advantage to gaining this area. Of course, they've learned that there's oil in many of these places here, so that's kind of changed things a little bit. But anyway, I thought that was interesting to show this. Jesus is born in Bethlehem, of only about 5 miles from Jerusalem, just prior to the death of Herod the Great. Remember that Herod heard about this. Who did he hear about Jesus from? The wise men. These were men who were given some sort of ability. And I don't know if we completely understand how they did this, but they were able to discern the seasons enough to know that Christ had been born, and they were seeking him. Of course, they tell Herod about this. Remember, Herod is this paranoid person that anyone who might have a possibility of a threat to him is going to be taken out. And he actually orders the slaughter, after pretending as though he was going to worship him, he orders the slaughter of babies during that time. And this was also prophesied in the Old Testament. So Joseph, Mary, and Jesus leave and go to Egypt. Get it right in a minute. And then eventually they're able to return back to Nazareth. We'll show Nazareth here in a minute. But this was where Jesus grew up. But Jesus was actually born in Bethlehem. And that kind of became a source of confusion later on when people knew that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem, but they were confused because Jesus was from Nazareth and because he had grown up there, not knowing that he had actually been born in Bethlehem in fulfillment of prophecies. Jerusalem remains a cultural and religious center of Judea, the cultural and religious center. People would have traveled there to attend Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Purim from Esther's Day. Remember when the Jews were delivered during Esther's Day? The Feast of Dedication that we mentioned earlier from the Maccabean deliverance. Of course, Jesus participated in that Feast of Dedication, among other feasts. There were certain rabbinical schools in Jerusalem. And they were, if you were a wealthy person and could afford it, you would send your son there to be educated. Remember, that comes into play later on, right? During the spread of the gospel. And I think we'll even talk about that of certain schools that were in place there. Well, John begins preaching in the wilderness of Judea. We'll show a map here in just a moment to kind of point out where this is. Most of Jesus' work occurred in Galilee. Galilee was an area to the north, probably not as prominent, not as many wealthy people or people. It's kind of like comparing the District of Columbia and the political power that resides there to maybe Alabama in terms of political importance, in terms of how it's perceived. But this is where Jesus has worked, and this is where Jesus sought people much of the time, not exclusively. But he spent a lot of his time there. Maybe they were more receptive. Obviously, it seems that they were because he was rejected by many of the leaders in Jerusalem. Capernaum was an important place in terms of Jesus' work. I think Walters even called it his capital. It was located on two important trade routes, had a Roman garrison, so it was a good place for him to operate in. We have Jesus doing many works in places like Cana, Nain, Bethsaida, Chorazin. He went up into Samaria, encountered a woman there at Jacob's well. You can believe a church is built over it today, but Walter's books even says you can go and visit and even draw water from it and have water from that well, which was, again, something that, of the Samaritans. Decapolis was a region, and you can kind of hear the Hellenized way in which that word is said. Decapolis was a Greek word. Deca, of course, we understand that word to mean ten, and polis indicated cities or political units, and that was a region primarily east of the Jordan, comprised of 10 Greek model cities. Remember, we talked about the Greeks establishing model cities in the places that they conquered. Again, this was an effort to promote their culture. Tyre and Sidon, two cities in the area of Phoenicia. So here's a map. Hopefully you can see this. The blue is Judea. This political district, I think, was all together and ruled by the same Herod. Samaria is really more in the central part of the area. You have Jerusalem here. You have Bethlehem about 5 miles to the south. Look at your look at our scale of miles here. So you're only talking about five, or, you know, roughly five, maybe a little more than that. Bethlehem, I believe Bethlehem was also up, kind of up on a, in terms of the mountains as well. Bethany is a little community where Lazarus and his family lived. The Mount of Olives is just east. We'll show some pictures here in a minute that kind of helps you see that. Of course, Galilee is up here. Cana is about right there. Capernaum is a little bit farther to the north, very near the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is there. The Dead Sea is here. The Jordan River running between them. Of course, those ancient rivers that we talked about early on in our study. Again, Jesus would have spent a good bit of his time here. The Decapolis region was this region, primarily east of the Jordan River, a little bit over to the left, but primarily east. Again, 10 cities. And of course, we read about Gilead and Perea. That would have been just west of the Jordan. Phoenicia is up north. I think Phoenicia at one time went further down. Tyre and Sidon, definitely places that are talked about in the Bible. Damascus is way over here. So hopefully that gives you a sense of where things are. This is real places, real people, the difference in the Bible as a religious document between that and other religious documents, such as the Book of Mormon and some of their writings, is that these can be verified, right? So here is a chart. I've got a couple of charts, and I'm no expert on ancient Jerusalem, and that'll be evident if it isn't already. You have the temple here. I've read it is estimated to be between 35 and 40 acres, the Temple Mount. And I read another estimate that said 145, so I'm not sure. Either way, it's big. And one of the largest platforms in the world, even still, I believe. Herod's palace was over here. This is called the Upper City. The Lower City is here. There's an incline to the city. It's up on a hill. The Pool of Bethesda, that's talked about in the Bible. If you look over here, the Valley of Kidron, there was a deep drop between the Upper City of Jerusalem, and then over to the east is the Mount of Olives. We'll show that here in another picture. The Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna. Anybody know the significance of that term? When Jesus spoke of eternal punishment in the New Testament, he used the term Gehenna. Gehenna was a Greek form of the word Hinnom. This had been an area, of course, it drops down in a valley, obviously. In the old times, there were sacrifices to ancient gods were there, including many sacrifices of children, including some kings of Judah and Israel. Ahaz was involved in that. This involved worship of Molech, an ancient false idol that people actually sacrificed their children. And by Jesus' day, it had become a garbage dump, places where dead animals were thrown, even dead people who maybe did not warrant a burial, such as criminals who died. And they would have been taken down to this area and burned. And I've read it, really a fire would have been kept there all the time to bury all the filth, sewage, dead animals, dead people would have been burned there in these fires of Gehenna. And Jesus uses that term as a synonym for eternal punishment in hell. The bodies would have been, obviously, worms would have eaten those bodies. And it was just a continual place where that was just going on all the time. And he used that to describe eternal punishment in hell, where the worm dieth not, he said. So I thought that was pretty significant. Probably a lot more that we can talk about. You can see the city was walled with And you can see also there are aqueducts. You know, if you were in a walled city, particularly up on a hill, you had to have a way to get water. You can't live without water or food. The Pool of Siloam, also mentioned in the New Testament, is here. Let's show the other chart. This is courtesy, you know, this is courtesy of Trent. It's really a good chart. This is kind of a topographical relief type of map. You can see over here, maybe, or maybe you can't see, the Mount of Olives is over here, and I'll show you a picture here. I won't dwell too much on this. Again, the Valley of Hinnom is down here to the south, west and south. And the Temple Mount would have been here. But you're up on the Mount of Olives, and there's about a 250-foot rise from the temple itself up to the Mount of Olives. So if you go up on the Mount of Olives, you can look down and see that temple. And it would have been a sight to see. Jesus even talks about that with his disciples. When his disciples said, "What glorious stones." And I think it would have even glistened in the white in terms of the light being white stones. What was going to happen to that temple? Going to be utterly destroyed by the Romans in when? 70 AD, 70. So, you know, by the time Jesus was an adult, late 20s, early 30s, it only had 35, 40 years remaining for that temple. This is a chart via courtesy of Trent that you took yourself. So this would be a great place to visit, obviously. And you may have to help me a little bit. Is this from the temple itself? Okay, from the south wall of the temple looking up at the Mount of Olives. And I think in his notes that he wrote to me to kind of help me understand the picture, there's a number of graves located on this mountain right as it slopes down, many of which may have been whitewashed. And I think that would have been that he referenced when he told the Jewish leaders, you're like whitewashed tombs. And those would have been tombs up on that hill. Again, probably whitewashed themselves. He may have even had that in mind when he was mentioned that to them. But again, the Mount of Olives is up. You can tell you can go up on the Mount of Olives and look down into the city. Of course, in their time, they didn't have electricity, so when it got dark, it probably got pretty dark. Maybe people burned fires and things like that to be able to see. But in the daytime, it would have been an incredible sight to see. Well, a couple of other things to mention. Nabataeans, not mentioned in the Bible, but they were an Arabian tribe, moved into the area not far from Judea. Once occupied by Edom and Moab, they had been a thorn in the side of the Greeks, and took a while for the Romans to conquer them as well, even after the close of the New Testament. But they are a place that's there on many of the maps. Again, we mentioned Bethany a few minutes ago, a place not far from Jerusalem, really up on the upper eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. Lazarus was raised there, of course. Again, we've talked about the Mount of Olives, 250 feet higher than the temple itself. Garden of Gethsemane was somewhere on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. And I was afraid I wouldn't have enough to fill the time. Looks like I've got more than I need. But some of this kind of gets into our next lesson anyway. God determined that he would establish his eternal kingdom sometime during the days of this fourth kingdom, which we understand completely now is the Roman Empire. And Jesus ascended into heaven on 29 AD on the day of Pentecost. You see a large number of people from all over the Roman Empire were present that day. You have them listed there. I won't read them. Got another chart that'll kind of show them. Again, there's our favorite chart again. Showing that we're now in the Roman Empire and God's kingdom is about to be established. This is a map that shows the different places from which people attended Pentecost. Remember, there were Jews scattered all over now. They had been, because of persecution, because of being captured, Many people went to a lot of different places, and again, we talked about earlier, there were Jewish synagogues all over the Roman world, and you can see all the way from Rome up through the province of Asia, Phrygia, Cappadocia, Pontus, Pamphylia, Mesopotamia, Parthia, Media, these would have still existed as minor places, Media still would, Elium down in Arabia, Egypt, Judea, Cyrene, Crete. Those are places that are mentioned there in Acts 2 as being present on the day of Pentecost when the miraculous event of the baptism of the Holy Spirit came down on the men there as they were speaking, giving God's approval for what they were doing and showing that, again, this is the initiation of a new period of time, God's eternal kingdom, Christ's law. Any question? We may have maybe a minute. Okay, Lord willing, we will finish up our brief study. I think our last class of the quarter, I think it's going to be more of a review. I think Tim's going to handle that. So anyway, thank you.